Astrid, and I am an alcoholic. What I want to do today is go more in depth into step one, because I feel that it's not talked about enough in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, step one states that I admit that I'm powerless over alcohol, and then there's a dash, and that my life has become unmanageable. So, the first part of step one, admitting I'm powerless over alcohol, in the big book it states that I have an allergy of the body, but the main part of the disease centers in my mind. So the allergy of the body is this phenomena of craving. The minute I have a drink, I want another drink and another drink and another drink. I can't stop. The plug must be put in the jug before I can go on any further into step one. But this is a very small aspect of a very big disease. It's not just the allergy of the body. It's not just quieting the phenomena of craving. We must go past this dash in step one into that my life has become unmanageable. And what's not discussed enough in Alcoholics Anonymous is the magnitude of unmanageability. People get up on the podium and they say things like, I flipped somebody off on the freeway today, I smacked my wife, I kicked the dog, but I've got 10 years of sobriety, I'm a winner today. This has nothing to do with treating the disease of alcoholism, which lives in my mind. So, if they say the main part of the disease centers in my mind rather than my body, how am I going to go and detect it? There's no x-ray, there's no blood test. What lives in my mind is a completely unmanageable thought life by me. My thoughts and my instincts have been warped through destructive drinking and through years of destructive thinking. And I don't even know the magnitude of what I'm up against. I am up against so much, that if I knew how much I was up against, I would never choose to gravitate towards a negative thought again. But this, unfortunately, has to be showed to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because myself can't reveal myself to myself. I can't see it. The interesting part is I can walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and I can look at other people and I can see so clearly their unmanageability, and I have no idea what I look like. Me, of myself, I'm still in unmanageability, and I'm only scratching the surface with being able to detect it. This unmanageability can be detected fairly easily once we get down to what is stated later on in the 12 and 12. There are ominous signs: worry, anger, self-pity, and depression. Where the 12 and 12 in step 4 also talks about the deadly sins: pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth. The big book talks about the 100 forms of fear that we're run by. And there's two basic fears. One of them is, I'm not going to get something that I want, or and the second one is, I'm going to lose something I already have. Then in step 4, we also go deeper into these instincts. We have these three basic instincts, which are the desire for sex, which can be the most barbaric aspect, is to mate and procreate. But it's also, how do I look to the opposite sex? My family life, my parents, my extended family. The next instinct is my instinct for security, my home, my car, my wallet, my belongings. I don't feel safe. I always want more. And the last one is the one to be somebody in society. Is anybody listening to me? Does anybody even like my opinions? Am I somebody's boss? Am I somebody's mother? I want people to recognize me. Does anybody even notice me? And all of these can become very out of control in a split second. So these areas are, we're just scratching the surface now. These areas are where the disease can hide and crop up. In the day I'm in, 5, 10, 15 years sober, it doesn't matter. And it awaits at every man's elbow or earlobe to resume its destruction. So it's there all the time. But once I start detecting it, then I can treat it with a power greater than myself and start getting some restoration towards sanity. This is where the need for a sponsor is so important. you've got to be able to start exposing your mind to somebody else. And you've got to get to the point where it's not charged with emotions of shame and guilt. You almost want to look at it like it's a separate entity, and it's not really you anymore. It's just a dialogue that goes on and on and on while you're trying to do something else, while you're trying to align your will with God's will. It's still telling you, you're too fat, you're too thin, you're not good enough, she's not doing it right, he's not doing it right, nobody's behaving the way you should, you don't have enough money, you should be driving that car and not your car, you should be the boss, and so on and so on. So what we begin to do next is we begin to take honest appraisal of our thoughts. There are several great practices you can do. One of them is when you sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, look at the clock. The meeting starts at 7 o'clock or 7:30. And look at the clock a half an hour later and notice how many times did you leave the room in your mind? How many times did you go somewhere else? Did you go to what you need to do later, to the grocery store, to something that angered you that day, to something that you think you're going to be doing tomorrow? This is where the unmanageability lives. And why is this so important to detect? Because in the beginning of the foreword of the 12 and 12, it states on page 15, AA's steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. The first promise in AA's 12 and 12 is that we are going to become happily and usefully whole. I don't want to be in a program of recovery. I don't know about you, but I don't want to be in a program of recovery if one of my goals isn't happily and usefully whole. And if it isn't accessible in the day I'm in, what's the point? I want to go for the good life, and it's got to be accessible now. This has to be as accessible for the newcomer, for somebody with one day or one week, as it is for somebody with 20 years. Again, this is not a time factor. This is not about how much time you have. This is about how accurate you have about your self-appraisal and how willing you are to treat your disease in the minute you're in the day you're in. This sentence that people throw all over the place of all I have is a daily reprieve contingent on the basis of my spiritual condition, this sentence should be etched in the hearts and the minds of every alcoholic, because there is so much truth to it. And for me, my program is contingent on the basis of my spiritual condition in the moment that I'm in. Because for me, alcoholism can crop up at any time throughout the day. Now, mind you, once it's being treated and it's been treated for a period of time, you can have whole minutes, whole hours, whole days, whole weeks, whole months, and even whole years where you do not slip into untreated alcoholism. In the beginning, though, it gets a little tricky. It's like throwing with your left hand. It's uncomfortable. What you're going to start doing is you're going to start talking to a power greater than yourself. If this disease lives in my mind, and I'm talking to my mind, and I have a self-talking disease, and it's powered by my thoughts, then what's going on up there? I'm talking to me all day long, which means I'm talking to the disease all day long, which means I'm still in untreated alcoholism, sober. So, this rockets me into step two once I really realize the magnitude of this. And what happens in step two is that I come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. What is sanity? It's soundness of mind. So, the practice is this. I'm either talking to myself or I'm talking to God. In the beginning, I have systematic prayers, very gentle, sweet ones that were given to me by others that have traveled this road. One of them is, God, can you help me see my alcoholism? Can you show it to me so that I know how to treat it? Another one is, God, can you protect me from my own mind? Because I don't know about you guys, but for me, my mind was killing me. It was killing me all the time. I would go to memories of the past, which is where the alcoholism loves to live. And I would think of the most horrific things I'd done or said or the pain I'd caused myself or others. And I could just sit, and it felt like battery acid being poured on me in the day I'm in. The sun could be shining, My space could be clean. Good things could be going on in my life. And I cannot produce a good thought by myself. I am so miserable inside. I think maybe I need a therapist. Maybe I need antidepressants. Maybe I need a new car. Maybe I need him. Maybe I need her. Maybe I need something outside of me. And what I'm not realizing is that if I can just treat my mind with a power greater than myself, I'm going to have all the promises that Alcoholics Anonymous has promised me. But I have to put this into application. Here's where the work has to be done. Here's where my will comes into play. The use of my will is to align it with God's will every single day. It is not to take my own will and run riot all over the place, cussing, screaming, yelling, speeding on the freeway, using my mind as a weapon to implode upon myself or explode upon my fellows. I have to learn how to align my will with God's will in my mind and stay centered with God. Again, here, I can admit that I'm a problem drinker, but I cannot endure the fact that I'm in fact mentally ill. This has to be brought to the surface. This has to become a part of my life. If I can admit unmanageability, if I can admit the fact that I'm mentally ill, guess what? This is where the relief is. Now I get to change. I have so much that I can turn over to a power greater than myself, and I get a true psychic change. What is a psychic change? It's that I begin to think, act, feel, and react towards my fellows and myself in a way that I was never capable of before. Now we go into page 21 of the 12 and 12. Step 1 states, who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. It is truly awful to admit that, glass in hand, we have warped our minds into such an obsession for destructive drinking that only an act of providence can remove it from us. I was taught in the 12 and 12, I can trade the word drinking for thinking at any time and be able to detect what my alcoholism is doing. So who cares to admit complete defeat? Admit is still not accepting. The word acceptance doesn't come into play until the end of page 21. So I'm still doing something under reluctance. I'm not totally accepting it. It's like the compliance versus surrender. I'll comply, all right, I'll admit it. But have I completely, wholeheartedly accepted complete defeat? No, I don't even know what I'm up against yet. So who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. I just briefly touched on the instincts a few minutes ago. Here's every natural instinct. These are my God-given, self-preserving, animal nature deep in my soul that I use to protect myself, to defend myself, to get what I need in life, to survive, to keep me alive. All my natural instincts cry out against the idea of personal powerlessness. This is so hard to admit at a soul sickness level that of myself I'm nothing, that I have warped and morphed myself so deeply that I'm really, really a destroyed and broken woman or man. It is truly awful to admit that, glass in hand, I've warped my mind. What is this warped? This word comes up many times, and it's a word that should go into everybody's vocabulary in Alcoholics Anonymous. This warped mind, if you can take a piece of wood and you warp it with water, there's no way you can unwarp it, which shows me my mind, with the drink in it and without the drink, is warped. That means it's permanently bent. It's permanently got destruction. It permanently doesn't work right. And there's only one thing that's going to fix it, and that is a power greater than myself. When I go to myself and when I go to my mind for information from the past or the future or opinions, I'm going to get in trouble unless my mind is occupied with a power greater than myself. Now, if we can go down into the third paragraph of page 21, the 12 and 12, where it says, our admissions, and it's plural, of personal powerlessness finally turn out to be firm bedrock upon which happy and purposeful lives may be built. So our admissions are ongoing. There are many admissions. I'm not just admitting the alcohol here. Here's where People get confused. They think it's just about the drinking. No, they forget the second part of step one. My admissions of personal powerlessness finally turn out to be firm bedrock upon which happy and purposeful lives may be built. Then we go down and we finally find this word accept in the fourth paragraph. We know that little good or no good can come to any alcoholic who joins AA unless he has first accepted his devastating weakness and all its consequences. What is my devastating weakness? My devastating weakness is my mind, because that's where the main part of the disease lives. If you can get this concept, you have got so much to work with. You have got the chance of just turning your entire life around and having something so new, so much better than you could ever imagine. But this has to be accepted. It can't be intellectualized. It's got to be downloaded into my feeling realm. Acceptance comes with a feeling of surrender, a feeling of, I'm open to it. Okay, I've swallowed and digested this unpalatable truth. This has to be done. The next sentence is, until he so humbles himself, his sobriety, if any, will be precarious. The opposite of humility is pride. So it's really what it's saying to me is, until I get rid of my pride, my sobriety, if any, is going to be precarious. What is precarious? It's unstable. Of real happiness, I will find none at all, proved beyond doubt by an immense experience. This is one of the facts of the AA life. The principle that I shall find no enduring strength until I have first admit complete defeat is the main taproot from which our whole society has sprung and flowered. Now I'm going to go down to the bottom of page 22. We're going to turn the page in 12 and 12, and the bottom paragraph states, in AA's pioneering times, none but the most desperate cases could swallow and digest this unpalatable truth. Even these last gaspers often had difficulty in realizing how hopeless they actually were. Okay, this, what has been shown to me here is, this last gasper, this hopelessness, is with the plug in the jug, with the phenomena of craving, with the allergy of the body, already have been treated. So there's no alcohol in my system now, and I'm still a last gasper, and it's an unpalatable truth. I don't want to admit the magnitude of defeat. And I'm gasping for air. I'm practically dying, and I don't even know it. And then it goes down to say, but few did, and when these laid hold of AA principles with all the fervor with which the drowning sees life preservers, they almost invariably got well. What's a drowning person look like when he's seizing a life preserver? He's going for that life preserver because he's just about to die. He's on his last leg, his last breath. I mean, there's maybe only a few moments left, and he's got this fervor to get to that life preserver. This has to be every single day for the rest of my life, a lifelong practice, that I lay hold of AA principles with fervor every single day. The more fervor I have, the more recovery I have in the day I'm in. When there's a lack of fervor, guess what I have? I have me, and I have untreated alcoholism. And it doesn't matter how much time you have in this program. That is an absolute myth, that if you have 20 years, you're more of a winner than somebody with 1 year or 6 months that's treating their alcoholism with a power greater than themselves. Now we go over into the top of page 23 on step one, second line down. Many less desperate alcoholics tried AA but did not succeed because they could not make the admission of hopelessness. Here again, it's not just the allergy. It's not that it's just the phenomenon of craving. It's the main part of the disease that centers in my mind. It's this hopeless thought life. We'll go down into the next paragraph. Three lines from the bottom. These people were spared that last 10 or 15 years of literal hell the rest of us had gone through. Since step one requires an admission that our lives have become unmanageable, how could people such as these take this step? Now let's go down to the last paragraph on 23, and six lines up from the bottom it says, It was then discovered that when one alcoholic had planted in the mind of another the true nature of his malady, that person could never be the same again. What is my true malady? It's my sickness. It's my disease. So when one alcoholic planted in my mind the true nature of the sickness of my mind, I could never be the same again. And hopefully I get to pass the AA baton and give this information to somebody else to help them save their life, to help them have a better and happily, usefully whole life, to help them treat a disease that lives in their mind and centers in their mind rather than their body. You know, this is such big stuff. This is so important. This is really AA uncut. This is pure stuff. It's worth its weight in gold. I don't take this lightly. This is what I'm talking about here is so serious. It has absolutely transformed my life. It has changed me so much for the better. Today, is it perfect? No. Is it a lot better? You bet. I have whole good days and whole good weeks where I don't slip into alcoholism in my mind. Okay, now let's turn the page. Page 24. Why all this insistence that every AA must hit bottom? The answer is that few people will sincerely try to practice the AA program unless they have hit bottom. This bottom for me is my mind. For practicing AA's remaining 11 steps means the adoption of attitudes and actions that almost no alcoholic who is still drinking or even who is still thinking can dream of taking. Who wishes to be rigorously honest and tolerant? Who wants to confess his faults to another and make restitution of harm done? Who cares anything about a power, higher power, let alone meditation and prayer? Who wants to sacrifice time and energy in trying to carry AA's message to the next sufferer? Nope. The average alcoholic, self-centered in the extreme, doesn't care for this prospect unless he has to do these things in order to stay alive. Under the lash of alcoholism, we are driven to AA, and there we discover the fatal nature of our situation. Then and only then do we become as open-minded to conviction and as willing to listen as the dying can be. This open mind to conviction, my mind must be open to the concepts I've just relayed to you that were given to me by others that have traveled this road before me. This self-centeredness, these things must be lucid. I have a fatal nature, it's telling me, that I'm going to die, and it can be sober, unless I'm as willing to listen as a dying man can be, that I stand ready to do anything which will lift this merciless obsession. What does a warped mind do? What are my ominous signs? What does it look like when I'm off track? What does a bottom look like? These are very important questions, and when I can begin to answer them, I can begin to get and grasp a much clearer concept of step one, of what I'm up against, and of how the disease operates, and what I'm going to be treating when I go into step two and I start coming to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Now I've got some meat. Now I've got some potatoes. Now I've got some kind of substance to work with, because I'm gaining an awareness of my disease. I'm gaining awareness of how much trouble it causes me in the day I'm in. I'm gaining an awareness of how I still have the total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. Relationships come and go, but this doesn't have to be the case anymore. Once I go into step two and then into step three and I start turning things over, it's going to get really good. Things are going to start healing, and I'm going to start finding a new and a better way of life. I think what I want to do before I go into step two is touch real quickly on the Tebow papers. Harry Tebow was Bill Wilson's psychiatrist, and he talked about these king baby characteristics, or the ego factor, and how this plays in with alcohol, or the alcoholic mind, or alcoholism. I need to ask myself these things. Do I often become angry? Am I afraid of authority figures? Do I attempt to work them against each other in order to get my own way? Do I seek approval and frequently lose my identity in the process? Am I able to make a good first impression, but I'm not able to follow through? Do I have difficulty accepting personal criticism and become threatened and angry when I'm criticized? Do I have an addictive personality? Am I driven to extremes? Am I self-rejecting or am I self-alienating? Am I often immobilized by anger and frustration? Am I rarely satisfied? Am I usually lonely, even when I'm surrounded by people? Do I feel that hopeless sense of isolation in a room full of people? Am I a chronic complainer who blames others for what's wrong with my life? Do I feel unappreciated and I think I don't fit in? Do I see the world as a jungle filled with selfish people who aren't there for me? Do I see everything as a catastrophe, a life and death situation? Do I judge life in absolutes, black or white, right or wrong? Is there no gray areas? Do I live in the past while fearing the future? Do I have strong feelings of dependence and exaggerated fears of abandonment? Do I fear failure and rejection and don't try new things that I might not do well in? Am I obsessed with money and material things? Do I dream big plans and big schemes and have little ability or no ability to make them happen? I cannot tolerate illness in myself or in others. Do I prefer to charm superiors and intimidate subordinates? Do I believe rules and laws are for other people and not for me? Do I become addicted to excitement? Do I live in the fast lane? Do I hold emotional pain within and lose touch with my feelings? This is another area of unmanageability. This is another area where the disease can operate and take over my life and steal my soul without my consent. And again, we're scratching the surface. But once we can at least examine these things for what they are and start to identify with them and start to see how they operate in our own lives, again, now I have something to offer this power greater than myself that I'm now going to build a relationship with. Step two of the 12 and 12 came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You know, when I first came to this program, I did have a bare start on what a higher power was, that there was a God out there, that I was not the spearhead of some primordial ooze, but the God that I had was a God that I feared and a God that lived way, way out in the stratosphere somewhere. And my sponsor made it clear to me that I had to find a God that could drive in the passenger seat of my car, that could sit next to me when I'm alone in a restaurant, that laid in my bed at night and listened to me expose my mind. A God that was accessible to me every minute of every day, because I carry a disease that lives in my mind and it awaits at my elbow to resume its destruction. And I can have a perfectly good morning and then one or two thoughts pop up and I go into untreated alcoholism and I need something that's going to treat it now. I might be on the freeway. I might be having a good time with my daughter or a conversation, and then all of a sudden I just go sour and my mind leaves the room and goes into some dark place. So I need to find a power that's accessible for me now. My sponsor had me go and ask four or five, and I've even asked more people after this. It's probably been a good 10 people that have a very good relationship with God and good recovery. Who is this God? What kind of God do you have? What can your God do for you? These people told me that their God could quiet their disturbance, that their God could neutralize anger, that their God could help them be hopeful for the future. He told them that their God could open up their hearts and help them to be more loving. That if they asked their God to help them read before they started a book or a certain paragraph that might be difficult for them to read or an interesting piece of material that might be hard to grasp, that God would help them focus, that God would help them grasp the concepts better. They told me that God could help their hearts open up so that they could love people that they were never capable of loving before. These people told me that God could help them see things in the world, see things about themselves, see things about other people that they'd never seen before. These are the concepts that became desirable to me. I wanted this kind of God. We come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Greater than myself means it can't be a sock. It can't be a fire hydrant. It can't be a doorknob. It's got to be something much bigger than me. And what I don't realize is
I'm a power all by myself, and I have a mind-powered disease, which is much more powerful than I want to give it credit for. So I need something that's much more powerful than my mind. My ego is very big. I have a lot of opinions about you, a lot of opinions about me, a lot of opinions about how things should be done, and all of those things need to be neutralized. And how are they going to be neutralized? I got to get something really, really big. So step two can't be intellectualized. It's got to be lived. Do you get this power greater than yourself all at once? No. The best way is to keep working with it, practicing, talking to a power greater than yourself, asking God to help you see things differently. You must get an open mind and keep an open mind as often as possible. Just try to stay open to something new. The more open you can get, the more you're going to have a God that's going to work for you. See, if I don't get a relationship with a power greater than myself, then what am I going to turn anything over to in step three? That's why step two, we got to get something real going here. We've got to get a real power, something that really works. Because if I go into step three and I start turning things over, turn over what? And turn over where? And what am I turning over? Turn it over like a pancake, and there it is in front of me. I need a God that's going to take my worries, my broken heart, the pit in my stomach when I'm in fear, the anger and the hostility I have, the warped instincts that I have, the warped mind that I have, the total inability to form a true partnership that I have. I need a God that's going to take those things and do for me what I can't do for myself. We go into page 25 on step two. The beginning states that the moment we read step two, most AA newcomers are confronted with a dilemma, sometimes a serious one. How often have we heard them cry out, "Look what you people have done to us. You have convinced us that we are alcoholics and that our lives are unmanageable. Having reduced me to a state of absolute helplessness, you now declare that none but a higher power can remove my obsession." Some of us won't believe in God. Others can't. And still others who do believe that God exists have no faith whatever that he will perform this miracle. Yes, you've got us over the barrel, all right. But where do we go from here? So, yay, we have a state of absolute helplessness. This means surrender. This means a good bottom. This is where the mind can be open and something new can come in. We have the cannots and the will nots. Cannots are some people who are so mentally ill that they're incapable. I was a will not for a very long time because I had way too much grandiosity and I still thought I could do it on my own power. And I couldn't. And when I finally let go and found a power greater than myself, that's when I started to get real recovery. Now we go down to the second paragraph. Let's look at the case of the one who says he won't believe, the belligerent one. This is the aggressive one. He has this savage mind, his whole philosophy in which he so gloried is threatened. So he it's bad enough to admit alcohol has him down for the keeps, but now still smarting from that admission, he is faced with something really impossible. How he does cherish the thought that man, risen so majestically from a single cell in the primordial ooze, is the spearhead of evolution, and therefore the only God that his universe knows. So many, many people really go to themselves, and they really do think and believe and act that they are the power for their life, and they can't grasp the concept of a power greater than themselves. Well, I feel badly for them, and I also can tell them, if it happened for me and I found a God, so can they. Now we get into page 26. We're going to turn the page. This newcomer thinks it's just about the last straw. This is the beginning of the end, and so it is. The beginning of the end of my old life and the beginning of my new emergence, or my emergence into a new one. Then the sponsor cries out, "Take it easy. The hoop you have to jump through is a lot wider than you think. Don't over-intellectualize God. That's the hoop. The hoop is, how happy can I be in the day I'm in and stay with God? The hoop is very, very, very big. Begin to laugh at the old character. Start building this new relationship and just jump off the cliff. you know and trust that there is a God down there. You don't need a parachute. You've got to take a leap of faith. Again, this is something that can't be intellectualized. It's got to be practiced. When? Every single minute of every single day. You don't do this thing once. You do it over and over and over. Okay, now we're going to go down into the paragraph that says that agrees the sponsor. And we're gonna go to where it says all of its 12 steps are but suggestions. Second, to get sober and to stay sober, you don't have to swallow all of step 2 right now. Looking back, I found I took it piecemeal. Third, all you really need is a truly open mind. And again, I had to take this God concept piecemeal. And I have to resign myself of which came first, the hen or the egg. Stop debating. Is there a God or isn't there a God? I, for me, had to take this leap of faith and decide there is a power greater than myself, because I can't go back. All that's left back there is alcohol and drugs or a gun against my head. There's nothing good back there. I've got to take this leap of faith and open my mind up and stop debating. That's the only thing that's going to cure my spiritual malady. That's the only thing that's going to heal my obsessive mind. That's only the only thing that's going to treat my alcoholism, which lives in my mind every minute of every day. I've got to open my mind. I've got to take a leap of faith. Now we're going to go over into page 27 of step 2, where it says the first paragraph, then I woke up and had to admit that AA showed results. Prodigious results. I saw that my attitude regarding these had been anything but scientific. It wasn't AA that has the closed mind, it's me. The minute I stopped arguing, I could begin to see and feel right there. Step 2, gently and very gradually began to infiltrate my life. This isn't all in one day. The skies didn't just open up and the trumpet started to blow. I had 46 years or 44 years of warping and morphing my mind into all kinds of sick terminology and dialogue that goes on in my head, and practicing communing with a power greater than myself and believing with a power greater than myself was not something I was doing on a daily basis. So I'm gradually coming to know this power. And it says, I certainly have that belief now. To acquire it, I had only to stop fighting and practice the rest of AA's program as enthusiastically as I could. Okay, this is a really important sentence. I practice the rest of AA's program as enthusiastically every single day as I can. This is how you keep this message fresh. This is how you keep Alcoholics Anonymous alive. It doesn't matter if it's 1 year or 20 years. You keep it fresh by practicing this program enthusiastically, by taking and working these steps and incorporating them into your life and living them as enthusiastically as you can in the moment that you're in. When we go down into the next paragraph, the bottom one on 27, if you don't care for the path I've suggested, you'll be sure to discover one that suits if only you look and listen. Many a man like you has begun to solve the problem by the method of substitution. You can, if you wish, make AA itself your higher power. Now, AA as an entity, as a whole, worldwide, not just several people in AA, that's not going to work. And this is a principle we're going to practice until we get a higher power of our own into play. Now the book on page 28 tells us about five different types of people that walk into AA. The one who had faith, the one who drifted into indifference, the one with self-sufficiency, the one who became prejudiced against religion, and the one who was downright defiant. So any shoe you want to put on, go ahead, you know, but don't wear it too long. We got to take it off and go someplace else. So, you know, what Bill's trying to do is speak to everybody, but humility is needed here. We got to go for something else, something that works. We got to open our minds and find a real user-friendly power greater than ourselves. Now we go down over into page 29, the intellectually self-sufficient man or woman. Yes, we were like you, far too smart for our own good. We loved to have people call us precocious. We loved our education to blow ourselves up into prideful balloons. Since we were brighter than most folks, so we thought, the spoils of victory would be ours for the thinking. The God of intellect displaced the God of our fathers. this is a very dangerous place, and I see this spiritual pride be the biggest stumbling block for people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They still think they can run on their own will. They still think they've got all the answers. They're still going to a warped mind. They're still going to memories of yesterday and rummaging around in a closet full of crap that doesn't work anymore, trying to get the proper answers. And they don't know what humility is. You turn the page to page 30. They helped us to get down to right size. This right size thing is humility. Humble myself. You know, true humility brings into your life everything that the ego has always wanted. It brings people to love you and respect you and desire to be your friend and have a relationship with you and listen to you. But you don't know that until you start practicing humility. So the last sentence at the top there, at the bottom of that first paragraph, when we began to do that, we received the gift of faith, a faith which works. This faith is for you too. I've got to take a leap of faith. I have to just try even a bare start of scratching the surface and start believing. If it can happen for other people and I see their lives becoming happily and usefully whole, it can happen for me. I've got to get a relationship with a power greater than myself. You know, this program can't be practiced without this. We can't have a Bush League pinch hitter where, you know, every once in a while I get in a jam and I get on my knees and I beg and beg for this God to help me. I need one that's accessible and accessible all the time. Now go up to the top of page 31 where they say, as psychiatrists have often observed, defiance is the outstanding characteristic of many an alcoholic. Gee whiz, does that sing anything to your soul? So it's not strange that lots of us have had our day at defying God himself. Sometimes it's because God has not delivered us the good things of life which we specified as a greedy child makes an impossible list for Santa Claus. Sometimes we think because we begged and pleaded God should fix this certain issue or just bring him or her back or have somebody forgive me, and it doesn't work that way. I have to have a God of my understanding, and in my understanding, my God is going to do things on his time and not mine. When I offer my problems to this power greater than myself, they get solved and resolved and put to rest in God's time. I'm just going to trust, though, that he's going to take them and that he's working on them so that I can be free in the day I'm in to go about my business without my mind completely aberrated. Go down to the last paragraph on 31. When we encountered AA, the fallacy of our defiance was revealed. At no time had we asked God what his will was for me. Instead, we had been telling him what it ought to be. No man we saw could believe in God and defy him too. Belief meant reliance, not defiance. Stop resisting this God. You got to go for it. This has got to be something you're going to get into action and you're going to start making happen. In AA, we saw the fruits of this belief. Men and women were spared from alcohol's final catastrophe. We saw them meet and transcend their other pains and trials. We saw them calmly accept impossible situations, seeking neither to run nor recriminate. This was not only faith, it was faith that worked under all conditions. We soon concluded that whatever price in humility we must pay, we would pay. You turn the page to 32. And you read the paragraph with to clergymen, doctors, and friends, and family. The alcoholic who means well and tries hard is a heartbreaking riddle. To most AAs, he's not. There are too many of us who have been just like him and have found the riddle's answer. This answer has to do with, guess what? The quality of faith rather than its quantity. This has been our blind spot. Okay, you guys. Another really important line here. It's the quality of my faith, not the quantity. So I got to find a God that works. As many aspects as I can examine and start believing in about this God that's going to restore me to sanity, the more a relationship of quality begins to happen for me. We supposed we had humility when really we hadn't. We supposed We had been serious about religious practices when, upon honest appraisal, we had found we had been only superficial. Or going to the other extreme, we had wallowed in emotionalism and had mistaken it for true spiritual feeling. In both cases, we had been asking something for nothing. The fact was, we really hadn't cleaned house so that the grace of God could enter us and expel the obsession. In no deep or meaningful sense had we ever taken stock of ourselves, made amends to those we had harmed, or freely given to any other human being without any demand for reward. We had not even prayed rightly. We had always said, "Grant me my wishes," instead of, "Thy will be done." The love of God and man, we understand not at all. So Bill Wilson's telling us, when we walk in here, we have very little or no understanding of the love of God and my fellow man. This is a lifelong practice. Therefore, we remain self-deceived and so incapable of receiving enough grace to restore us to sanity. Again, a lifelong practice. We could read these sentences over and over every day to let them grow as seedlings in our soul. Therefore, we remained self-deceived and so incapable of receiving enough grace to restore us to sanity. I need humility. I need to humble myself before a power greater than myself. I need to open my mind to this power, and I need to start practicing a communing relationship with this power greater than myself. Side two, step two. Okay. The last line on page 32, which begins the second to last paragraph in step two, says something very important. Few indeed are the practicing alcoholics who have any idea how irrational they are, or seeing their irrationality can bear to face it. Some will be willing to turn themselves problem drinkers, but cannot endure the suggestion that they are in fact mentally ill. Okay. Mentally ill doesn't mean we're so crazy that we're walking down the street talking to ourselves again, although it can. I've seen that too. What it means is I have a disease that centers in my mind, and it tells me a whole lot of BS about me, about you, about the world. It tells me how I should operate. It tells me how I should act. It tells me what I think I need to make me happy, and it's a lie. I need to start occupying my mind and my thoughts with a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. So, these alcoholics are abetted in this blindness of a world which does not understand the difference between sane drinking and alcoholism. Sanity is defined as soundness of mind. Yet, no alcoholic, soberly analyzing his destructive behavior, whether the destruction fell on the dining room furniture or his own moral fiber, can claim soundness of mind for himself. Therefore, step two is the rallying point for all of us. Whether agnostic, atheist, or former believer, we can stand together on this step. True humility and an open mind can lead us to faith. And every AA meeting is an assurance that God will restore us to sanity if we rightly relate ourselves to Him. And somebody gave me a really sweet little paragraph that was on Bill Wilson's desk for many years, and it says, humility, and then there's a definition underneath it. Humility for Bill Wilson was perpetual quietness of heart. It is to have no trouble. It is never to be fretted or vexed, irritable or sore, to wonder at nothing that is done to me, to feel nothing done against me. It is to be at rest when nobody praises me. And when I'm blamed or despised, it is to have a blessed home in myself, where I can go in and shut the door and kneel to my Father in secret and be at peace, as in a deep sea of calmness, when all around and about is seeming trouble. Now we're going to go into step three, page 34. This step has to do with willingness, and more willingness. It also has to do with faith. Okay, so it starts out, practicing step three is like the opening of a door, which to all appearances is closed and locked. All we need is a key and the decision to swing the door open. There is only one key, and it's called willingness. Okay, what is willingness for us? It's something done without reluctance. I've got to be so open to try something new. I've got to be as willing to do this as a dying man. My life's depending on it, and my life better become important to me, or I'm not going to get this thing down, and I'm going to have a very poor quality of recovery or no recovery at all. Once unlocked by willingness, the door opens almost of itself. And looking through it, we shall see a pathway beside, which an inscription it reads, "This is the way to a faith that works." Okay, so we have to start practicing faith. Even a bare minimum is what we need. Go down to the second paragraph on page 34. Like all the remaining steps, step three calls for affirmative action. It is only by action that we can cut away the self-will, which has always blocked the entry of God, or, if you like, a higher power. Faith, to be sure, is necessary, but faith alone can avail nothing. We can have faith and yet keep God out of our lives. This sentence, again, is, sure, I can believe in God. You know, I can look at nature, and I can look at the planets and the solar system, and, yeah, there's got to be something out there bigger than me. But you know what? I've got to get this God a whole lot closer. I need to put this God in my life, not keep this God out of my life. I have to build a relationship where this God is right here with me. Therefore, our problem now becomes just how and by what specific means shall we be able to let him in. Step three represents our first attempt to do this. In fact, the effectiveness of the whole AA program will rest upon how well and earnestly we have tried to come to a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. You know, so many people just bypass this sentence like it's nothing. That's pretty big, Bill Wilson. That's pretty, pretty big. AA's program will rest upon how well and earnestly we have tried to come to a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And it's telling me that my program is not going to be on a firm foundation. I've got to show real willingness. I have to suit up and show up. I have to make a big decision. When? Do I make it once in year one? No. Again, this has got to be lived every minute of every day. Okay. First paragraph up on page 35. To every worldly and practical-minded beginner, this step looks hard, even impossible. No matter how much one wishes to try, exactly how can he turn his will and his life over to the care of whatever God he thinks there is? Fortunately, we who have tried it and with equal misgivings can testify that anyone at all, can begin to do this. Dun, 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 dun. We can further add that a beginning, even the smallest, is all that is needed. Once we have placed the key of willingness, that's doing something without reluctance, in the lock, we have the door ever so slightly open. We find that we can always open it some more. Though self-will may slam it shut again, as it frequently does, it will always respond the moment we again pick up the key of willingness. So from my own personal experience, what happened especially in the beginning was I'd get up in the morning and I'd do a prayer and I would say, God, I'm going to turn my will and my life over to you. And I'd be fine, maybe for even an hour or two. And then I'd get a phone call from somebody and they'd say something that would irritate me or a problem would crop up. And I'd take my will back and I wouldn't give it to God. And then I'd have to remind myself, oh, yeah, right, I'm in a program of recovery. I have to offer this to this God again. And if whatever it is in the day I'm in, if I can offer as much as I've got in the day I'm in to this power greater than myself, I am going to have a much easier day. If I can offer everything from what I'm going to wear to what I'm going to say to is financial security coming in or going out? Does he like me? She like me? Whatever the problem is, you know, the problems are gazillions of them. You know, we went over those in step one. It doesn't even matter what they are. Just I need to begin to have the willingness to turn all of these problems over to a power greater than myself. Because then I'm going to go down to the bottom of 35. But suppose that instinct cries out, as it certainly will. Yes, respecting alcohol, I guess I have to be dependent upon AA, but in all other matters, I must still maintain my independence. Nothing is going to turn me into a non-entity. If I keep on turning my life and my will over to the care of something or somebody else, what will become of me? I'll look like the hole in the donut. So what happens is my ego is afraid that I'm going to turn into nothingness if I keep giving all my problems over to a power greater than myself, because my ego and my alcoholism are so used to running the show, orchestrating everything, telling you what to do, telling me what to do, that this is very uncomfortable, or can be in the beginning. Maybe even uncomfortable isn't the right word. It is so different. It feels so peculiar in the beginning to offer something to a power greater than myself and stop orchestrating. The paragraph goes on to say, this, of course, is the process by which instinct and logic seem to bolster egotism and so frustrate spiritual development. The trouble is that this kind of thinking takes no real account of the facts, and the facts seem to be these. The more we become willing to depend on a higher power, the more independent we actually are. That's huge. Let me say that again. The more I become willing to depend on God, the more independent I actually am. You know what? Anyone that's done this knows what I'm talking about. It is so beautiful when it begins to happen. You get the peace that passes all understanding. You get a life you never thought possible. The agitation, the restless, irritable discontentedness, the warped instinct, the 100 forms of fear begin to dissipate. God takes them. God takes care of them. God soothes my soul, and my mind isn't walking around in untreated alcoholism all day long. Here's where the relief is. And what it gives you is not, what this gives you now is a life where drinking isn't necessary ever again, one day at a time. You know, there's this formula they talk about out there where my best day out there has no comparison to my worst day in here. And I don't know who made up this formula, but for a long time, alcohol and drugs treated my mind, because I couldn't quiet the disturbance. My mind and my thoughts and my emotions were so noisy all the time. They just ran me. And I was trying to treat my mind with drugs and alcohol. What happens when you get a foundation in steps 1, 2, and 3 is you begin to live in a world where drinking is not necessary. Now, that sounds very desirable, very attractive to me. The second paragraph on page 36 talks about the dependence of power, and they compare God to electricity. And I can tell you, I definitely have power outages during the day, and then when I conform my will with God's will and I commune with Him, the power goes back on. On the top of page 37, this is a classic example of flip-flopping into alcoholism and then back into a program of recovery treated with a power greater than myself. We just call it flip-flopping. The moment our emotional or mental independence is in question, how differently we behave. How persistently we claim the right to decide all by ourselves, just what we shall think and just how we shall act. Oh yes, we'll weigh the pros and cons of every problem. We'll listen politely to those who would advise us, but all decisions, the decisions are to be ours and ours alone. So the moment my emotional or mental independence is in question, how differently I behave, this is when I need to go to God even more. And in the beginning, what can happen as you're starting to build this foundation, let's just say you're about to get fired, or you've gotten an eviction notice, something really big, something that's really rattling an instinct and rocking your foundation. This is when you need to give it to God more than ever. And this is when my emotional and mental independence is in question. This is when I find myself going back into my mind, taking back the power, and going into untreated alcoholism. And, you know, this is often below the level of consciousness. I don't even know I'm doing it. I don't even know I've done it, because I go back to automatic pilot. I don't even know I've done it until I'm wallowing around in it. But as I practice these principles and I practice going to God more and more, it gets easier to start staying with God. Go down a little further in the flip-flop paragraph on 37, and it says, besides that we think there's no one we can surely trust, we are certain that our intelligence, backed by willpower, can rightly control our inner lives and guarantee us success in the world we live in. This brave philosophy, wherein each man plays God, sounds good in the speaking, but it still has to meet the acid test. How well does it actually work? One good look in the mirror ought to be answer enough, or one good look at your track record when you've operated from self and from whatever you can pull out of your mind to solve a problem, that ought to be answer enough that you need a power greater than yourself. See, we didn't get here because we were good people. We got here through the circumstances, and they weren't good, and it tells us that when we turn the page. Page 38, three lines down, it says, so it is by circumstance rather than by any virtue that we have been driven to AA and have admitted defeat, have acquired the rudiments of faith, which are just the starts of faith, and now want to make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to a higher power. Let's hop over into page 39, where the first paragraph says, so how exactly can the willing person continue to turn his will and his life over to a higher power? He has made a beginning, we have seen, when he commenced to rely upon AA for the solution of his alcohol problem. But now, though, the chances are that he has become convinced that he has more problems than alcohol. And you see, once again, the more problems you can admit that you've got than alcohol, the more God can restore you to sanity. If you're not willing to admit and accept and look into what your mind is doing and how you're operating and your character defects and your sins and your instincts, you're not going to get very far. You're going to walk around with untreated alcoholism. So it says, he has more problems than alcohol, and that some of these refuse to be solved by all the sheer personal determination and courage he can muster. They simply will not budge. Hello. They make him desperately unhappy and threaten his newfound sobriety. Our friend is still victimized by remorse and guilt when he thinks of yesterday. That can happen after 20 years of recovery. Bitterness still overpowers him when he broods upon those he still envies or hates. That can happen with somebody with one day and with somebody with 20 years. His financial insecurity worries him sick, and panic takes over when he thinks of all the bridges to safety that alcohol burned behind him, or alcoholism burned behind him, because it doesn't just take drinking to create destructive behavior. And how shall he ever straighten out that awful jam that cost him the affection of his family and separated him from them? His lone courage and his unaided will cannot do it. Surely he must now depend upon something or somebody else. And the next paragraph says, at first, that somebody is likely to be his closest AA friend. He relies upon the insurance that his many troubles, now made more acute because he cannot use alcohol to kill the pain, can be solved too. Of course, the sponsor points out that our friend's life is still unmanageable, even though he's sober, that after all, only a bare start on AA's program has been made. More sobriety brought about by the admission of alcoholism and by the attendance at a few meetings is very good indeed, but is bound to be a far cry from permanent sobriety and a contented and useful life. That is where the remaining steps of the AA program come in. Here's a big sentence. Nothing short of continuous action upon these as a way of life can bring the much desired result. And here comes a really important statement that Bill Wilson makes. Then it is explained that the other steps of the AA program can be practiced with success only when step three is given a determined and persistent trial. Again, only when step three is given a determined and persistent trial. This statement may surprise newcomers who have experienced nothing but constant deflation and a growing conviction that human will is of no value whatsoever. They have become persuaded, and rightly so, that many problems besides alcohol will not yield to a headlong assault powered by the individual alone. And what he's saying is, we've got lots and lots of problems, and by our own power, by our own self, we can't do it. our past becomes our future. We try over and over and over. We promise it's going to be different next time, and it isn't. Lack of power is our dilemma. We must take spiritual principles, and we must apply a program of recovery and find a power greater than ourselves to start turning these. I'm going to end this tape with some simple prayers. If this is all too much for somebody to take in at once, which is an awful lot of information, keep asking God for the willingness. Ask God to help you hear this. And ask God for the desire to keep wanting this. This message and this God is accessible to everybody. You just have to petition the power greater than yourself and back it with the performance that you know God is there. Thanks for letting me share. Have a lovely day. Bye.